This program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the January 6th 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: the Trump administration won international policy concessions sought by Republicans and companies to reshape a global corporate minimum tax deal without abandoning it. U.S. stocks began the year's first full week of trading with a kick that lifted the Dow 1.2% to a record, and the S&P 500 and NASDAQ by 0.6% and 0.7% respectively. GM and several rivals reported year-end sales slumps, a sign that U.S. vehicle sales will slow this year as consumers resist higher prices. AT&T, the sixth biggest employer in Dallas, is planning to relocate its global headquarters from the city center to the nearby suburb of Plano. U.S. factory activity fell in December, defying expectations amid a pullback in production and inventories, a survey of manufacturing firms shows. Universal Music will acquire a minority stake in Indian movie and digital content studio Excel, boosting its presence in a market with high growth potential. Bed Bath & Beyond appointed its executive chairman of the board, Marcus Lemonis, as its new chief executive. The highest tariffs in almost a century haven't caused the huge surge in inflation many economists feared, but that shouldn't come as a surprise, according to two new studies. Novo Nordisk's Wegovy weight loss pill is now broadly available across the U.S., 2 weeks after it received U.S. regulatory approval, the Danish drug maker said. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. Ousted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro pleaded not guilty to drug trafficking charges at his arraignment in U.S. federal court in New York City, defiantly telling a judge that he was still the head of his nation. A profitable bet by an unknown trader on Poly Market, closely timed to Maduro's downfall, fueled suspicions of insider trading. ICE plans to send more than 2,000 personnel to Minnesota, where a multi-year social services fraud scandal has continued to grow. The Pentagon moved to demote Senator Mark Kelly, a retired captain in the U.S. Navy, over his participation in a video calling on troops to reject illegal orders. The U.S. is dropping universal recommendations for certain childhood vaccines in a stark overhaul of the immunization schedule and vaccine policy generally. The Health and Human Services Department endorsed the use of self-administered tests for the virus that causes cervical cancer to increase access to screening. A meeting between China's Xi Jinping and South Korean leader Lee Jae-myung highlighted a pivot in Beijing's attitude toward North Korea's nuclear weapons. A man was taken into custody after allegedly damaging the Ohio home of Vice President J.D. Vance, the Secret Service said. Died Michael Schumacher, 75, wide-ranging author. The picture on today's front page shows Maduro and his wife surrounded by federal officials as they disembark from a helicopter. And that caption reads, Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores were led out of a helicopter Monday in cuffs on their way to federal court in Manhattan. The article, I am innocent, Maduro tells judge. Ousted Venezuelan leader calls himself prisoner of war at hearing in New York by Corinne Rami and James Finelli. Ousted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro pleaded not guilty to drug trafficking charges during his arraignment in U.S. federal court in New York City on Monday, defiantly telling a judge that he was still the head of his nation despite being whisked away by U.S. forces over the weekend. Quote, I am innocent. I am not guilty. I'm a decent man. I'm still the president of my country, he said through a Spanish interpreter, adding that he was a prisoner of war and had been kidnapped from his home in Caracas. Maduro's top lieutenant, Delcy Rodriguez, was sworn in as Venezuela's acting president Monday, as remnants of the regime moved swiftly to assert control. Security officers were out in force in Caracas, running checkpoints and patrolling neighborhoods to prevent protest. The raid in which Maduro was arrested generated criticism Monday at the United Nations, where the U.S. was accused by several countries of violating global rules and norms it helped craft. French envoy J. Damahikari said an act that contravenes UN principles chips away the very foundation of international order. In Manhattan, Monday's hearing kicked off a nearby unprecedented legal battle over a foreign leader in U.S. court. The arrest of a head of a state presents challenges for both prosecutors and the defense, and the two sides could spend years sparring over the legality of Maduro's arrest and charges before he goes to trial. Maduro, who ruled his country for more than a decade, shuffled into court in shackles before being seated next to his lawyer. He shook hands with those around him and wished people in the packed courtroom a happy new year. When Maduro continued to argue in court that he was wrongfully apprehended, the judge interjected, telling him there would be a time and place to make those arguments. Maduro's wife, Celia Flores, sat at the same defense table, showing what her lawyer said were signs of injuries sustained during her capture. The Maduros face charges including cocaine importation, conspiracy, and possession of machine guns. The two defendants are being detained at a federal jail in Brooklyn. Their lawyer said neither was seeking bail, but might do so in the future. Maduro's lawyer, Barry Pollack, told the judge that before trial, he planned to make arguments about the legality of Maduro's abduction and his immunity as a head of state. U.S. prosecutors had previously charged Maduro in 2020 and by 2025 offered a reward of up to $50 million for information leading to his arrest. The U.S. doesn't recognize him as Venezuela's legitimate president. The new indictment, unveiled Saturday just hours after the incursion into Venezuela, accuses Maduro, Flores, and four other defendants with a 25-year-long conspiracy that involved partnering with violent drug traffickers to distribute tons of cocaine to the U.S. Maduro sits atop a corrupt, illegitimate government that, for decades, has leveraged government power to protect and promote illegal activity, including drug trafficking, prosecutors wrote. The indictment alleges that Maduro took steps to advance the conspiracy, including selling Venezuelan diplomatic passports to drug traffickers and ordering kidnappings and murders against people he believed owed him drug money. Outside the courthouse Monday, police set up barriers along the sidewalks, which were packed with dozens of chanting protesters, including some carrying signs saying, USA, hands off Venezuela. Inside the courtroom, a man stood up after the hearing and shouted to Maduro in Spanish. I'm a prisoner of war, Maduro said in Spanish, as court officers escorted the other man out of the room. The next hearing has been set for March 17th. Other articles from the front page follow. Trump's approach to the Americas, speak loudly and carry a big stick. President signals the U.S. is returning to a policy in an era of interventions. By David Ludnow, Juan Ferrero, and Vera Bergengruen. The U.S. might have decided it no longer wants to be the world's policeman, but the military operation that captured Venezuela's autocratic president shows it is far more willing now to be the enforcer in its own hemisphere. President Trump's audacious decision to seize Nicolas Maduro from his Caracas compound and whisk him to New York to stand trial on drugs and weapon charges heralds a new geopolitical strategy. The U.S. and the U.S. only will dominate the Western Hemisphere. For the Trump administration, that is Washington's core interest, a vision laid out recently in its national security strategy. In the wake of Maduro's arrest, Trump has warned Colombia's leftist president that he could be next, said Cuba's regime was likely to fall soon of its own accord, and again raised the idea that the U.S. should control Greenland. American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again, Trump said Monday. Hours later, the State Department put out a picture of Trump emblazoned with the headline, "This is our hemisphere," echoing Trump's hard-edged rhetoric in an unusually blunt tone for the nation's diplomatic agency. Call it a return of the Big Stick School of Hemispheric Relations, a throwback to U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt. The policy is pushing some Latin American governments to toe the U.S. line, but it could result in pushback from Latin Americans who do not want to see a return of U.S. interventions in the region. It could also anger longtime U.S. allies. Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen of Denmark said any move by the U.S. on Greenland would mark the end of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization Security Alliance, a comment quickly backed up by the UK government. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Diplomatic efforts gave way to military action. President Trump grew frustrated after repeated attempts to persuade Maduro to leave office. By Vera Bergengruen, Juan Ferrero, Alex Leary, and Kijal Vias. 6 months before he sent U.S. forces to seize Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, President Trump wanted to cut a deal with Maduro, not forcibly remove him from power. During a July meeting in the Oval Office, Trump told advisors that he wanted to keep negotiating with Maduro's regime to reach a deal to give priority to U.S. oil companies seeking to pump Venezuelan crude, opting for diplomacy with the autocratic leader. Trump acknowledged that Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who had long cautioned him against trusting Maduro and believed oil revenues would bolster his regime, opposed the approach. But Trump, according to people briefed on the discussion, said he wanted a deal. We're doing it my way. In late December, the president decided in favor of military action, fed up with repeated efforts to persuade Maduro to leave office in exchange for amnesty for his alleged crimes. The brazen overnight operation on Saturday ended with Maduro in a jail in New York. In Trump's second term, Venezuela quickly became an unlikely convergence point for his priorities. Mass deportations, drug trafficking, the lure of the country's vast oil and mineral reserves, and a longstanding push by Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants, and other hardliners to depose its brutal regime. Venezuela is a perfect storm. It's everything the Trump administration is concerned about, said Elliot Abrams, who handled Venezuelan affairs in Trump's first term. Trump's fixation on the country's resources, expressed to allies after he took office for the second time, triggered behind-the-scenes jockeying among his advisors and oil lobbyists over the shape of his Venezuelan policy. Trump made it clear he cared more about a bargain from Caracas that served his America First agenda, including cooperation on deportations and favorable oil deals, than pressing for a democratic transition. Ultimately, Rubio and Trump's other hawkish advisors came out on top after they convinced the president that Maduro was a drug trafficking terrorist who wouldn't leave power on his own. For his part, Maduro saw Trump's pressure campaign as a bluff, according to former aides and businessmen close to the regime. On December 23rd, Maduro rejected what he didn't know would be his final offer to leave office. Instead of living out the rest of his days in exile with his family, a helicopter lifted him and his wife out of Caracas and into U.S. custody. Trump, for now, has cautiously embraced the Venezuelan leader's second-in-command, Delcy Rodriguez. Maduro was provided multiple very, very, very generous offers and chose instead to act like a wild man, chose instead to play around, Rubio told reporters Saturday. And the result is what we saw tonight. White House firms win key concessions in global tax deal. U.S. firms will face minimum taxes in many countries where they operate. By Richard Rubin, Washington. The Trump administration won international tax policy concessions sought by Republicans and companies, reshaping the Biden-era global corporate minimum tax deal without abandoning it. The U.S. had threatened to blow up the agreement last year, warning that it interfered with the nation's prerogative to set its own tax policy. That prompted other countries to seek a path that would accommodate concerns from President Trump and congressional Republicans. The U.S. paused those threats in late June. Then the administration stayed at the negotiating table for the rest of 2025 to reach the consensus announced Monday by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The updated agreement achieves two main U.S. aims. First, it prevents other countries from imposing taxes on U.S. companies based on the idea that U.S. companies pay too little tax on their U.S. operations. Second, it makes minimum tax math more favorable to the U.S. research and development tax credit and similar incentives elsewhere. Those changes should shield U.S. companies from taxes that would otherwise hit them, and foreign-owned companies won some reprieves, too. Keeping the U.S. inside the global deal is important because it shows continued international commitment to keeping a floor under corporate tax rates. Manel Corwin, the lead OECD official in the effort, said in an interview Monday. Hospitals become test labs for AI, by Tay Ping Chen and Chao Deng. Samir Aboud, chief of emergency radiology for Northwestern Medicine, thought he was already working at maximum speed. In a carefully honed routine, aided by voice dictation, he could finish writing an X-ray report in as little as 75 seconds. Then the Chicago-based health system rolled out generative artificial intelligence in 2024 that can analyze patient scans and write reports. Aboud, who checks the AI work for potential changes, said reviews have sped up to about 45 seconds. The result was breathtaking and startling. It was the first time I felt there was a clock on my career, Aboud said. Still, he said humans are a necessary part of the process. And reading scans faster came with benefits, too. There's hundreds of patients waiting for our read, and any one of them could be one that's actively dying, Aboud said. Big hospital systems have become the proving ground for widespread AI adoption, testing what the technology can do, but also revealing, sometimes via alarming mishaps, where it falls flat. Among health systems, 24% are paying for commercial AI licenses, triple the rate across the U.S. economy, according to a Menlo Ventures and Morning Consult survey. While the aging population's healthcare needs rise, hospitals are looking for ways to deal with persistent worker shortages that can burn out clinicians and delay care. They are also looking for efficiency while cuts to Medicaid loom. AI has especially broken through in some of the least flashy but most labor-intensive hospital tasks, taking notes, fielding patient phone calls, and dealing with insurance claims. Doctors still make medical decisions, though AI can aid the process. Now for other articles within the paper. Trump to freeze social service funds in more states. The Trump administration said Monday it was expanding its freeze on social services funding to California, Colorado, Illinois, and New York over fraud concerns, according to senior administration officials. The government last week cut off Minnesota's federal child care funds following allegations of fraud involving the state's social services system. There is no indication the other Democratic states had similar allegations. The officials confirmed that the Department of Health and Human Services will freeze taxpayer funding in the four states from the Child Care Development Fund, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Program, and the Social Services Block Grant Program that allows states to tailor services to its population. Minnesota's Democratic Governor Tim Walz dropped his reelection bid Monday in the wake of the fraud scandal. He has said the Trump administration was using the investigations into the fraud as an excuse to cut federal assistance programs. Federal prosecutors allege that over several years, dozens of people siphoned public money from Minnesota's social services operations. And that was by Alicia Luckpath and Meredith McGraw. New article, Governor Walz drops bid for a third term. Minnesota Democrat bows out, bruised by welfare fraud scandal. Klobuchar eyes a run. By John McCormick and Ken Thomas. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz has dropped his bid for a third term amid a massive welfare fraud scandal, a remarkable fall for a politician who had ascended to the national stage in 2024 as the Democratic vice presidential nominee. Senator Amy Klobuchar, the state's senior senator and a 2020 Democratic presidential candidate, is seriously considering a run for his job. Three Democrats informed of her thinking said. One of the people said she hadn't yet made a decision on the race. A Great Geezer Revival for Aaron Rodgers by Jason Gay. Look who RSVP'd. Aaron Rodgers is back in the playoffs. The peripathetic 42-year-old quarterback, poet, philosopher, and Pat McAfee content machine remains among the football living after Pittsburgh eliminated Baltimore 26-24 Sunday night in a messy do-or-die doozy in which the kickers for both teams missed critical kicks in the final minute. Winning ugly, really ugly, but they'll take it. Who wouldn't? It's a mighty accomplishment after a sterling late career performance. 31 for 47 passing, 1 TD, 294 yards passing, 133 in the fourth quarter for Rodgers, who arrived in the Steel City eager for a soul cleanse after two exasperating decades interning with the Meadowlands experimental comedy troupe, the New York Jets. Did I say 2 decades? Sorry, 2 years. It sure felt like 2 decades. A weary Rodgers, barely a season out from Achilles surgery, was on the brink of retirement, wondering if he could love football again, which is the only sensible state of mind after a couple of seasons lost to the Jets. The Steelers offered what the Jets couldn't: tradition, stability, a long-term coach, and the ability to get through a Sunday afternoon without the rest of the country pointing at the television and laughing. After a bit of an exhausting intrigue, will he or won't he? Rogers was in, and very in. Grabbing a terrible towel and wrapping his expanded mind around all that Steeler mystique, assuming the cool dad role to younger teammates, and turning back the clock just enough to wedge himself into the postseason for the first time since 2021 with his original outfit, Green Bay. Lot of gratitude for the journey, Rogers said when it was over. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Windows were broken in Vice President J.D. Vance's Ohio home, which was vacant at the time, the Secret Service said. A man has been taken into custody. From Sam Green, USA Today Network, Reuters. From the editorial page, Welfare Fraud Takes Out Tim Walz. It isn't often that politicians pay a price for the failures of government, but on Monday, we may have seen a rare and welcome example as Minnesota Governor Tim Walz ended his campaign for a third term in November. The transparent reason is that the state's sundry welfare scams have become a political vulnerability for him and his fellow Democrats. More than 90 defendants have been charged in schemes to defraud Minnesota's various welfare programs. The first indictments were filed under Joe Biden and involved a pandemic-era program for feeding children when schools were closed. But the scope of the investigations has grown as prosecutors uncover how more programs were looted. Defendants allegedly set up sham businesses and falsely claimed to provide meals to children, paid kickbacks to parents to enroll kids without autism in autism treatment, and build Medicaid for phony housing services to addicts, among other scams. Some state workers raised red flags about the apparent fraud, but the money kept flowing. Mr. Walz at first defended the welfare grift as a regrettable consequence of his state's charity. Quote, right now, we're the most generous state in the nation when it comes to these programs and services, and we should be proud of that, he said last April. He has largely stuck to that line, though he has recently promised, under political pressure, to do more to stop criminals. As the welfare heist has drawn national attention, Democrats have blamed Mr. Walz and claim the problems are isolated to Minnesota. While the state's lax spending oversight enabled the fraud, its vast entitlement programs invited it. When government throws around money with little concern for results, this is what happens. Democrats for years have hailed Minnesota as a Midwest model of progressive governance, with its high taxes and Scandinavian-style entitlements. This was among the reasons Kamala Harris tapped Mr. Walz as her running mate. Now Democrats worry that voter disgust with welfare fraud could evict Democrats from Minnesota's State House in November. Democrats boast a one-seat majority in the state Senate, and two House vacancies have given Republicans temporary control of the House. Progressives may be happy to sacrifice Mr. Walz to preserve their control in St. Paul and avoid a national debate about whether the vast tentacles of the welfare state have grown too big to manage or justify. From the opinion pages, Maduro and the Democratic Socialist. Zoran Mandani misses a chance to distance himself from Venezuelan socialism. By William McGurn. A few days ago, Zoran Mandani was riding high. He'd just been sworn in as mayor of New York, the first South Asian, the first Muslim, and the first African-born person to hold that office, as befits what he sees as the Big Apple socialist moment. The new mayor promised to govern expansively and audaciously. Quote, I was elected as a democratic socialist, and I will govern as a democratic socialist, he said. The crowd cheered. His speech was upbeat, defiant, and most of all, confident. That was Thursday. On Saturday, President Trump changed everything by dispatching U.S. forces to Caracas, Venezuela, to grab Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, and bring them to the U.S. to face criminal prosecution for charges ranging from narco-terrorism conspiracy to weapons possession. They pleaded not guilty on Monday. Across the U.S., but especially in South Florida, people who fled the repressive socialism of Mr. Maduro or his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, cheered Mr. Trump's decisive intervention and this opportunity to take their country back, not Mr. Mandani. There are many ways he could have reacted. Given Mr. Maduro's thuggery, Mr. Mandani, who had a good Oval Office visit with Mr. Trump in November, could have drawn distinctions between the democratic socialism he espouses and the more ruthless version practiced in Venezuela. The mayor might have made clear that he, too, has zero tolerance for Venezuela's involvement in the international drug trade. He could have pointed out that the U.S. wasn't deposing a legitimately elected Venezuelan president, but a man whose government wasn't recognized by the U.S. and some 50 other countries. Mr. Mandani, alas, made no such statements. Instead, on Saturday, he called Mr. Trump. I called the president and spoke with him directly to register my opposition to this act, Mr. Mandani said at a press conference. And to make clear, it was an opposition based on being opposed to a pursuit of regime change, to the violation of federal and international law. I registered my opposition, the mayor said. I made it clear, and he left it at that. Even Chuck Schumer did better. The Senate Minority Leader made clear he thought Mr. Trump's intervention was wrong. You don't treat lawlessness with other lawlessness, and that's what happened here, he said Sunday on ABC News' This Week with George Stephanopoulos. But Mr. Schumer also made clear this was no endorsement of Mr. Maduro, whom he called a horrible, horrible person. Such words go too far for Mayor Mandani's Democratic Socialist. The group issued a statement accusing Mr. Trump of launching a nakedly imperialist war to install a U.S. puppet government that will give Venezuela's oil resources over to U.S. corporations and to force U.S. hegemony over Latin America. The party's demands include the return of Mr. Maduro and his wife to Venezuela and the total withdrawal of U.S. warships, fighter jets, and military assets from the Caribbean. There are legitimate questions the Trump administration will have to answer about this intervention and what's to follow. But for Mr. Mandani and his Democratic Socialist, Mr. Trump's intervention represents an existential crisis. It raises a fundamental question. Is their socialism really all that different from Mr. Maduro's? The Democratic Socialist website puts it this way. Our vision pushes further than historic social democracy and leaves behind authoritarian visions of socialism in the dustbin of history. Mr. Mandani's election was taken as a sign that the socialist movement had mellowed and matured. Today, in America, socialism is more Zoran Mandani's smile than Bernie Sanders' scowl. And some of the mayor's most troubling statements on, say, Israel, are offset by his pleasant image. He looks more like a Columbia grad student than the stereotypical bearded revolutionary. Just before Christmas, in what now seems like the distant past before the U.S. military captured Mr. Maduro, these questions about socialism were still largely abstract. On December 21st, the New York Times ran a piece on a Democratic Socialist of America convention in New Orleans Hilton. Attendees, said the Times, were galvanized by Mandani's big win in New York. In the understatement of the year, the Times admitted that the Democratic Socialist's biggest challenge may have nothing to do with Donald Trump or Zoran Mandani, but with socialism itself. Some of its policies, says the paper, even if pursued, may not work. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Four myths about the capture of Nicolas Maduro. In the reality, it was a superbly executed act of strategic opportunism that removed a vexing enemy, by Gerard Baker. For someone so voluble, loquacious, President Trump isn't the most effective at articulating a rationale for his strategic thinking. His foreign policy is so unusual in the context of recent history that almost every action he takes is subject to a range of fevered interpretations from friends and critics alike. So it was last week, following the military operation to remove Nicolas Maduro, dictator of Venezuela, and bring him to the U.S. for trial. The daring enterprise has engendered a host of grand theories about Mr. Trump's strategic decision-making, the ideas behind it, and its implications. In all these exegesis, critical interpretations, there are at least four myths and one important truth. Myth one. This was a law enforcement operation to bring to justice a notorious narcotics trafficker. The officially stated reason for Operation Absolute Resolve is also the least plausible. I have great regard for Jay Clayton, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, and I have no doubt he will bring a watertight case against Mr. and Mrs. Maduro. But no one buys the claim that this was an initiative primarily in pursuit of criminal justice. Mr. Maduro and his wife pleaded not guilty Monday. For one thing, the last Latin American head of state convicted in a U.S. court on drug trafficking charges was just granted a pardon by Mr. Trump. So the administration's commitment to rooting out narco presidents seems less than solid. For another, Mr. Trump, with his characteristically blunt capacity to say things that contradict his own officials, waxed lyrical all weekend about the operation's blessings for Venezuelan freedom, democracy, oil, and the Donroe Doctrine. Which brings us to myth two. The removal of Mr. Maduro will result in an energy bonanza for the U.S. The prospect of access to oil was surely a big factor in the decision to effect a regime change, but its implausibility lies in the unlikelihood of its being realized. There has been excited commentary about how Venezuela sits atop 300 billion barrels of oil, but how that means, at current crude prices, that the U.S. just took control of an asset worth $17 trillion. This is flawed thinking geologically, mathematically, and economically. The country's heavy oil isn't easily extracted. It will require massive capital expenditure to get back to the 3 million barrels a day the country was producing a few years ago. In the unlikely event it did open up significant additional production, the addition to world supply would depress oil prices. For many U.S. energy producers, $50 a barrel oil is below production cost. Whatever benefits may flow from Venezuela won't change America's energy equation. Myth 3. This latest exercise in U.S.-led regime change represents the ultimate discrediting of America First foreign policy restrainers. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, transfigured in the media from her previous role as everyone's favorite nut job to her new status as a sagacious observer of geopolitics, was widely quoted making this case. Regime change, funding foreign wars, and America's tax dollars consistently funneled to foreign causes is what has most Americans enraged, she tweeted. But Mr. Trump's foreign policy was never as restrained as some of his supporters wanted it to be. As he showed in his first term with the successful strikes against Iran's Qasem Soleimani and Islamic State's Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he has never been shy about deploying U.S. force. The same was true for the attack on Iran's nuclear facilities last summer. The Maduro raid is entirely consistent, a quick and apparently successful strike that delivers a blow to America's enemies without resulting in lengthy entanglements. Myth 4. The operation is a disastrous break with U.S. historical respect for international law and sets a terrible precedent that will be exploited by Russia and China as an excuse to achieve their own objectives. Give me a break. Two, actually. First, the U.S. has a long history of removing unfriendly leaders on questionable legal grounds going back at least three quarters of a century. From Iran's Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953 to Chile's Salvador Allende in 1973, Panama's Manuel Noriega in 1989, to Iraq's Saddam Hussein in 2003, and many more in between. What's more, this latest action hardly constitutes a green light for dictators everywhere. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, suggested the seizure of Mr. Maduro would now be emulated. What prevents China from claiming the same authority over Taiwan's leadership? What stops Vladimir Putin from asserting a similar justification to abduct Ukraine's president? I have news for Mr. Warner. Mr. Putin was not declined to capture Volodymyr Zelensky because of his deep regard for the niceties of law. Xi Jinping, fresh off defying international law in the South China Sea and tearing up his country's treaty with the UK over Hong Kong, isn't somehow being prevented from seizing Taiwan's leader because some lawyer in Beijing has been telling him that isn't how America behaves. So much for the myths. The reality is this. The Maduro grab was a superbly executed act of strategic opportunism that removed a troublesome enemy in the region most vital to U.S. interest. Ultimate judgment on it will rest on its long-term outcome. But for now, it sends a message to friends and foes alike. We have the capacity and the will to eliminate ruthlessly those who would cause us harm. Will Trump's resolve hold up? Beijing, Moscow, and Havana will seek to engineer a quagmire for Washington. By Walter Russell Mead. Operation Absolute Resolve demonstrated again that the worst mistake a world leader can make is to underestimate Donald Trump. Immured in his Brooklyn cell, Nicolas Maduro will have ample time to reflect on how much better his life would have been had he taken Washington's warnings seriously and slipped into a luxurious exile. In Cuba, Nicaragua, and beyond, other leaders will ask themselves whether the time has come for a graceful retirement. Globally, the usual suspects were quick to chime in with the usual critiques. Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and their increasingly nervous allies deployed every cliche in their arsenal against the American operation. The dwindling band of bitter clingers to the dream that the magical force known as international law will bend the arc of history toward justice were predictably outraged. Domestically, opposition politicians chanted the traditional laments about executive usurpation and congressional war powers. Wilsonians bewailed Mr. Trump's disregard for Venezuela's democratic opposition. Isolationists fumed that he acted at all. Pundits who failed to predict the operation in the first place gravely stoked their chins before intoning that the Venezuelan adventure must inevitably fail. The jubilation among the president's supporters was almost equally futile and premature. The operation was a dazzling and magnificent act, and the competence and the resolve that it demonstrated will do more to shore up American power and world peace than all the best speeches President Obama ever made. But as Mr. Obama learned in Libya and President Bush discovered in post-Saddam Iraq, it is the after-party and not the event that causes the biggest headaches. The Trump administration's ability to navigate post-Maduro Venezuelan politics is currently unknown. 6 months to a year from now, absolute resolve could be forgotten in the rush of greater events look like one of America's greatest foreign policy successes, or become an albatross around the administration's neck. Success won't require only a mixture of luck, cooperation by the robust remnants of Chavez Maduro political machine, and the full engagement of Mr. Trump's unrivaled political instincts. It will also require the kind of integrated, efficient planning and interagency cooperation that Mr. Trump's penchant for personalistic management and chaotic governance makes difficult to mobilize and sustain. Complicating the task will be deep and determined resistance from the many Cuban, Russian, Chinese, and Iranian assets embedded in Venezuela's security forces and political structures. The consolidation of an America-friendly stability in Venezuela would be a humiliating and damaging setback for Russia and China. It would likely be a mortal blow to the Cuban regime. Similarly, the financial power of the drug cartels and the deep networks they've established in Venezuelan police and security services mean that American efforts to end Venezuela's role in the drug trade will meet considerable resistance. Mr. Trump's utter lack of scruples about democracy and institutional integrity will simplify the task of finding and encouraging Venezuelan partners to implement his agenda, but it would be dangerous folly to underestimate his opponents. Not much is clear about the administration's intentions for post-Maduro Venezuela, but Team Trump clearly hopes to avoid what it sees as the Bush administration's mistakes in post-Saddam Iraq. There will be very few, if any, American boots on the ground. Stability, not purity, will be the goal. Washington will enable and cooperate with any regime elements prepared to dance to America's tune. We should expect to focus on restoring and increasing Venezuelan oil production as a paramount American goal. The blowback from absolute resolve won't be confined to Venezuela. China and Russia will rightly look at the American strike against Mr. Maduro as a challenge to their power and prestige. The strike on Venezuela, like last summer's Operation Midnight Hammer against Iran, was an American attack on the revisionist Axis, where the Axis was weak. Planners in Beijing and Moscow will be hunting for areas of American weakness as they look to retaliate. Terror strikes, escalation in Russia's military campaign against European targets, escalation in the undeclared cyber war now raging between the West and its enemies. Since the Vietnam War, America's enemies have identified the fickleness of public opinion as Uncle Sam's great weakness. We are unbeatable when it comes to shock and awe, but we do less well at grinding wars of attrition. Further, the divisions in American society that Chinese and Russian propaganda and intelligence operations attempt to exacerbate at every opportunity are particularly acute in the Trump era. Countering the success of Operation Absolute Resolve will be job number one in Havana, Moscow, and Beijing. Turning Venezuela into another quagmire will be the first and most obvious goal. Escalating the international